Sehr gut, sehr gut, sehr gut.
Sehr gut?
Wieso Steuer ist sehr gut? Das sagen ganz viele.
Wer sagt das?
Stiftung Warentest, Computerbild, Focus Money, Chip, Finanztipp, such dir was aus.
Mega, aber das ist doch bestimmt kompliziert.
Nö, einfach Foto von der Lohnsteuerbescheinigung machen und fertig.
Klingt sehr gut.
Ist sehr gut. Mit Wieso Steuer? Bis zum 31. Juli abgeben.
Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 32, Episode 5. Coming up on the show, we've got the scout ships of New York's Stone Gateways, the aliens' fake delivery trick, and a tender kiss from the Greys. I'm your host, Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
Do they, like, try to deliver something and then report in the app that they've dropped it off and then it's not there?
Oh, you mean like all the couriers in Australia?
Yeah.
No. I'm talking about a labor delivery.
Oh, I see. A baby.
In a pregnancy delivery.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's this trick they use where the person, the abductee's drugged and then they find themselves on a table with their legs open in the birthing position. And then they'll be like, what's going on? And the Grey will like go and reach down between their legs. And
ew.
Be like, oh, you just gave birth to a baby. Here.
Like a squid thing.
Hold it. And it's like, clearly 2.5 years old, like some weird hybrid freak. And the lady's like, "Boy, I wasn't even pregnant." And no, here's your baby. Hold it. Give it a kiss.
So they're like, what's that bird? Is it cuckoo birds that like put their eggs into other birds' nests?
Oh, so the birds raise. It is a bit like that.
Is
so
that what it is?
So the baby bird's raised by the other species' mother.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have to do the raising.
Where is this all coming from?
A lot of it is from the work of Kim Carlsberg.
Oh,
do you remember this book?
I do.
No, a better question is, do you remember episode 601 of our podcast? Check the date.
Are you serious right now?
Check the date.
July the 15th, 2011.
Should we listen to it?
No.
How bad was it?
I'm a completely different person.
Let's listen to season 6.
Welcome to Mysterious Universe, season 6, episode 1. Coming up on this show, we have a Mothman hit and run in Georgia.
What happened to your voice?
Why do I sound like a massive... What is going on? What happened to me?
You can't say that, Ben. That's wildly offensive.
601 is the podcast where we last, if I scroll down, you can last see The Art of Close Encounters by Kim Carlsberg. That's the last time we spoke about it. So she...
Was she the author of that book where on the cover, I think it was like, it was groundbreaking in the field and it was about hybrids. And I recall the cover, it's like it's half human, half alien. And it was basically her diary. It was like her diary of ongoing abductions. Is that the same author? I'll have to look it up.
Well, I don't have any memories from 2011, obviously. It's all a blur going back 3 weeks. But the reason I wanted to get into this is because in the last Plus show, we covered this audio documentary from Stuart Davis,
mm-hmm.
who is a very talented musician. And he revealed in this documentary, which I'll link to in the show notes if you haven't heard it. It's called Man Meets Mantis.
It's the book, Beyond My Wildest Dreams, Diary of a UFO Abductee. I'll link to it in the show notes. I remember seeing this actually, speaking about years ago, when I was about 14 years old. And for whatever reason, just even the cover, there's something which is inherently terrifying about it.
Do you mean this one?
Yes.
Beyond My Wildest
Dreams?
Yeah,
there's something really just,
Well, that's what I'll be talking about today.
Oh, okay,
because
great.
Because this came out in...
30, 40 years ago.
No. Actually. No, this is 2016.
No, this book has been out for years.
This is 2016.
No.
What do you mean, no?
No. I'll look it up for you.
What are you talking about?
This book has been out for years.
How could it be? She's talking about events from 1992.
Her first book published nearly 2 decades ago.
Yeah, that's this.
So 1995 was when it came out.
This one, Beyond My Wildest Dreams.
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Why does it say published in 2016?
Because that's the Kindle edition.
Oh.
The paperback came out in 1995.
Fuck this. Done. Had enough.
Because how can I see it as a 14-year-old and be really free? Now I'm like, I know my memory's bad, but I was like, did I imagine that? Am I actually fabricating?
Well, you don't even know what we talked about on season 6, episode 1 from 2011. Why would I rely on your memory?
This show is a train wreck already this week. This is bad. This is really
bad. So anyway, I'm going to be talking about that book. But what I was talking about with Stuart Davis is he revealed that his inspiration, his muse for a lot of his creative works, which included three movie scripts and a film, which is may or may not be released in Russian, and a bunch of albums. His muse was an encounter with a praying mantis entity in 2010.
Yes, that's right. And it was a stunning story that he told, but also very unsettling at the same time.
And he recognized that despite his drive of creativity coming from this being, he claimed he received telepathic messages from it, weird influences in terms of what to be interested in, and these movie projects came from it. He acknowledged that some people's lives have been ruined by typical encounters with these entities, and one of those people is Kim Carlsberg. So I'll be going into hers. I can't remember a thing from my 2011 coverage of it, so hopefully you don't either. And that goes for you, Aaron, and everyone listening. What have you got coming up?
I don't know.
Oh, great.
Okay, no, I do. I do know. I do know what I got coming up. Actually, this ties into, we're going to be taking a look at some of these New York stone chambers. There's a really interesting connection that I found. There was a laboratory back in the mid-80s that did some investigations into these stone chambers. And you can see them. Like, you'll know the images as soon as you see it, and I'll bring some of those up later on in the show. But these are essentially stone chambers. Yeah, here we go. That have been, historians have suggested that they are... was it root cellars for, early settlers? It was also alleged that they were created by the American Indians.
These are all the ones in the Northeast, right?
That's right. Now, some of them may very well be that, but, a lot of reports are suggesting that American Indians go, we didn't build them. Like, these aren't ours. There doesn't seem to be any significant records demonstrating that it was built by settlers. Mm. So where did these things come from? Well, there's some suggestion in some of the finds there that these things are thousands and thousands of years old. But it becomes even more unusual when you find out that the physicists from the Lamont Doherty Observatory in New Jersey said that they found a very strange magnetic field anomaly right here, which seemingly connects it to the Hudson Valley UFO sightings
really?
Of the 1980s.
That's weird.
So we will get into that a little bit later on in the show.
Well, looking forward to that. One of the best ideas I've had from these is that they came from other people who were in the Americas, because the design, the structure of them is similar to what you would see from Celtic people.
They came from Druids.
Yeah, right. It's the same. Yeah, the same Druid structures.
From Celtic Druids.
It's fascinating to think that there are so many different people in ancient America.
Well, I mean, there's some allegations according to oral traditions of American Indians that they came through, like these people came, right?
And the moon-eyed people.
Well, no, they didn't call them moon-eyed people. They called them people with their faces on fire. And it wasn't that their faces were on fire, obviously. It's that they had red beards.
Big,
thick red beards. And so they were described. And it's like, it seems to be pointing back to this as some type of Celtic tradition. But of course, being Druids, are they a gateway of some kind? Well, one researcher suggests that they may very well be exactly that. So we'll get into that. Just hold on.
Well, I just read that they stored their beer in there.
Roots. Just a bunch of roots that were in there. No, there was a whole...
But this is a mysterious universe, so there's going to be a portal. We're going to be making out with some greys and other things. So, yeah, let's look at this work from Kim Carlsberg. Not this book. This one, Beyond My Wildest Dreams, Diary of a UFO Abductee. Published to Kindle in 2016.
Yeah, but published in 1995. And I remember it being in this obscure occult bookshop or alternative bookshop in Brisbane all these years ago. And even though the cover it's a drawing, like it's not an actual picture, it's just, for whatever reason, and obviously we'll link to it so you can have a look, it elicits a sense of something that's very uncomfortable.
Wait, does that mean that this art one came out later?
Yeah, this one's only relatively recently. This is the second book. And in fact, I remember we were at, I think it was maybe a Nexus conference where they were talking about publishing it. So, you're worse than me. Look at your face.
I don't fucking care. I don't care.
Oh, I could thanks for that before as well. I could just imagine the comments right now, the triggered people that are like writing comments and reporting you. That's
also
great.
Also don't care. She says in the beginning, it is my personal conclusion that the entities you see on the cover, they're not extraterrestrial, they are extra-dimensional in origin. Mm. She says they emerge into our density and solidify. Unlike the other abductees I've met, she says, most of whom only have vague, fragmented memories, she's fully conscious through many of these experiences. So she does report some regressions, which I'll go through later on in this segment. But a lot of things are just her diary entries from events that happened the night before, where she's woken up from this visceral experience. She calls them dreams in parentheses to say that.
Yeah.
Well,
it's a way to protect herself, I think.
Yeah, in quotes to say that she calls them that, but they're not that.
Yeah.
They're real tangible experiences. She says one of the things that might have led to her being able to recall these memories, because most can't, is that she has a really strong, extreme reaction to drugs of any kind. Like if she can't take any antibiotics, she's incredibly allergic to them. But on the inverse of that, if she goes to the dentist and they give a Novocaine or something, it does nothing.
Really?
In fact, she was scheduled to have a dental appointment, she explains, and she had to walk out because the dentist gave her 10 shots and it didn't do anything.
Surely, though, he couldn't have given her 10 shots. I mean, that potentially could be lethal.
And that's what she said, 10 shots of Novocaine. And the dentist was like, okay, get out. We can't do this. So her first diary entry I want to mention comes from the summer of 1998. She says, "Dear diary, I think I'm losing my mind. I hope so, because if what happened to me last night was real, I don't know how I'll be able to live with it, but I want to remember every last detail." So she describes getting back from work, and she was a photographer. She had graduated from art school, and she got a bunch of jobs on movie sets being like the set photographer. Her boyfriend, Greg, he gets up really early to work out at like 5 a.m, so he's dead to the world. So she slips into bed beside him, falls asleep really easily, and she wakes up and she's no longer in her bed. Just abruptly like that, she's somewhere else. She's standing in what seems to be an elevator. Now, I've got an image of this on the screen here. Let me just zoom out a little bit. She's standing in this elevator.
There's grays in the background.
She's naked, and it's this claustrophobic small enclosure, and she's packed in with all these other bodies jammed into this corner. She can't see anything. She says the stench of rotting flesh is suffocating.
Yeah, they stink.
This horrible smell. She said, "I didn't know where I was, how I got there, or how I could have been taken from my bed in the middle of the night without waking up. But there I stood," she said, "with my nose pressed against this steel door." She said, "I felt paralyzed, but my mind was alert. I couldn't even move my head from side to side." And out of the corner of her eye, she strains to see who's standing next to her. You can see this guy in the sketch. And it's her old boyfriend, David. Now, I don't know if he still lived in California or what the deal is there, but that's her ex, naked in this squashed space. And there's another woman standing next to him. She says, "I couldn't see her physically, but something told me she was there." And there's no time to think about it because the door opens and they're pushed into this large room. And she said, "What I saw next was horrifying." So it looks like a giant hospital ward, but there's just rows and rows and rows of operating tables, as far as the eye can see, that are a few feet off the ground. You know, so not the height we would be used to, they're lower. And there's all these human beings unconscious or dead on these tables. Now, she can see these small naked beings, as we can see in the image there, the greys as we know them now, these bald heads, big black eyes, not wearing any clothing, but no genitalia or anything, hovering over these beds, doing things to these unconscious people. And she notices a Caucasian male in his 40s on the table next to her, completely unconscious. Two creatures are working on this man. One's holding his head, the other's examining his wrist. And she's convinced all these people are dead and she's next.
Mm.
So she starts.
You freak out.
Shrieking. She starts screaming. Now, to her right, she describes four beings that seem to be in charge. They're two gray-looking entities, but they're a little bit taller. They're like 5 feet. The rest of them are 3 feet tall. And there's two others which are completely different. They're taller again, but they seem to be phasing in and out of the room. Like they're physical and then they're unphysical. They're physical, like a TV set flickering on and off. She said they were 9 feet tall. They look like waterfalls of energy. So she's there shrieking, screaming, and two of these taller creatures rush over to her And one of them gives her like a Spock slap on the neck. And she says it's like anesthetic and she's immediately losing consciousness. The other one stands in front of her and is just staring at her with those big ugly eyes. And that's the last thing she remembers. She just collapses in front of it. And she says, I woke up later in a smaller room. Immediately, she's hysterical again. She's like, where the hell am I? Again, cold metal table. One of those hideous creatures is like lurking in the darkness. And she sensed that whatever its task was, it had finished it. And now it was waiting for further programming, like its next instructions.
Yeah, because they're robots. They're drones.
And she sees that in the space she's in, this door opens. And the first thought when the entity walks through is that, oh, this person's dying of cancer because she's so gaunt and thin and her hair is in patches. It's this hideous female creature. We've got the image on the screen here. And she says, she sees it's a woman, it's a female. She's like, oh, please, please, you've got to help me, you've got to help me. And this creature just says, why don't you stop being such a big baby? This is going to be finished soon if you just shut up. And immediately she gets this sense of, like I said it with, you know, sarcasm and emotion, but she says there was none of that. It was just this really cold, dead tone delivery.
Yeah, because there's no humanity about them at all.
And that's when she understood it was actually telepathic. It was beamed into her head. It wasn't a real conversation. And suddenly she finds herself back in her bed. She's sleeping next to Greg. Well, not sleeping. She's wide awake next to Greg, who's fast asleep. And boyfriend, actually, not husband. And she feels heartbroken because he didn't wake up. She's like, they took me and you didn't wake up. Like, what's wrong with you? And she didn't want to wake him up now because she didn't want to try and explain what had just happened to her.
Well, also, if this is just a first experience, you're probably going, and probably a few of them, you'd probably rationalize them as being dreams. Like, come on, if you wake up in a bed, you're like, oh, wow, that was a really vivid dream.
Yeah, it was just so real. She knew that. That's why in her diary, she's like, I hope that was a dream because otherwise I'm going nuts. Anyway, she waits for him to, she pretends to be asleep so he can get up and he gets dressed and he goes off to his gym workout in the morning. And she kind of gets up and, like, in a daze, goes over to the window. She's still in shock about what happened. And she looks out because they live right on the coast near the beach. And she looks out, she can see one of the lifeguard towers.
Mm-hmm.
And it immediately brings back the memory of a dream she had only two nights earlier. And this was a similar situation where she'd come home late after a shift on, she was working on like Pee Wee Herman movie. She comes home, it's nearly 2 a.m. when she's finished. And just to unwind a bit, she kind of makes a drink and just sits in front of the glass windows they have and looks at the ocean. And she describes this star, you know, looking a bit odd.
Mm.
And it's one of those stories where the star kind of zips across, responds.
Well, it
to
grabs
her
your
thought.
Attention.
It responds. It's like it responds to her thought and it starts hovering in front of the window. And while it gets close, she is paralyzed. She can't take her eyes off it and she's kind of frozen by this thing. It eventually zips away at astonishing speed and disappears. But she realizes, hang on, these two experiences must be connected. She just has this feeling. So anyway, she can't get these things out of her mind. She's trying to just convince herself this is a dream and she keeps pushing back the memory of the faces of these things. Like she just doesn't want to even indulge in recalling the thought of them. It's so hideous. And she says a part of her kind of steps in and takes control and is like, okay, time to go to work and do your job. Let's not think about that thing that happened. So she does this.
Well, it's like a psychologically protective kind of thing. When you're dealing with something you can't deal with, you either collapse and you're not able to function or you kick into drive and you kind of erase everything else.
She gets to work and one of the guys that she's friendly with at work, who they've got a good relationship, they're both from Missouri originally, he takes one look at her and he's like, what the hell happened? Because she looks like a mess. She says, oh, I just had a bad dream. I couldn't sleep. He's like, no. You tell me what happened.
That's not a bad dream.
And eventually, after some, you know, comforting from the guy, she tells him, like, I had this experience and it must be a dream, this crazy dream. And he says, listen, don't think about it now, but let me take you out for dinner tonight and we'll talk about it. And yeah, he's just being nice to her, takes her out to dinner. And that's when he tells her, he's like, if this is a dream, you and hundreds of other people across the world have described the exact same thing. She's like, what are you talking about? He's like, okay, let's go for a ride. They jump in the car. He takes her to a bookshop and he buys her Missing Time by Bud Hopkins. And he's like, start reading this. So she's reading this book, just going, holy, what's going on? She'd never heard of this stuff before. She starts writing a letter to Bud Hopkins describing her experience. She puts it in an envelope and she's ready to send it off, but something stops her. The second day, she tries to send it again, but something stops her. She can't bear to do it. And on the third day, for some reason, she tears up the letter and throws it in the bin. It's like something is stopping her from talking about this. Now, she says, that was it. It was over. I tore up the letter. If this happened to me, I don't want to think about it again. That's gone. I need to get on with my life.
Don't you find it unusual, though, that she was able to tell this story to an acquaintance, but then when she tries to contact a noted researcher, something prevented her from doing that?
Well, the way she describes it, it's like he really didn't give her an opportunity to say no. He was so insistent and he knew her so well because they were good friends. That's, I guess, she could trust him. Some stranger that she doesn't know is a different situation. But anyway, over the next 2 years, from the outside, her life looked great. Her boyfriend, Greg, he pitched a show to NBC. He had this crazy idea of doing a show about lifeguards and it became Baywatch.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was the producer of Baywatch. And so he was doing really well. He was super busy, working long, long hours. But the show was a huge success, obviously. They ended up moving to a really nice house in Malibu. They were right on the beach. And he was being drawn into his career. Like, that was... These were the years he was kicking ass. And she, from the surface, it looked like she was doing good, but she was being drawn into the nightmares. She was being taken more and more often. And she says, I stuffed them into the closet of my subconscious, but the closet became full. I could no longer conceal the truth from myself, she said. And this is where we get more of these diary entries. She writes that September the 29th, 1990, dear diary, over the last few years, I refuse to acknowledge the strange dreams and suspicions I've had to the, what?
1990?
Yeah, what's going on? Like, the opening one is 19, what was it?
1998.
And then she says 1990. And I'm just copying from the book. It's just, I don't know, maybe it's a woman wrote it.
Ben!
Let's just...
This is twice this episode.
What?
Are you trying to get us actually kicked off YouTube?
What? What's your problem? What? You've read as many books as me. You notice these things as well. Yeah, so anyway. 1990. What was it? 1990. Yeah. She says, dear diary, over the last few years, I've refused to acknowledge these strange dreams and suspicions I've had. To the point I stopped writing in my diary, but after last night, I can no longer stay in denial. So she basically went to bed as usual, suddenly woke up in the middle of nowhere, naked, lost, and she's running through a thicket of trees. It's not California anymore. It looks like the Northeast somewhere, like you were just describing. And she's running from this searchlight in the sky. She's feeling like the trees hit her as she's rushing past. And she has the feeling that she's prey trying to escape from a pack of wolves. That's just what it feels like. And her blood is pumping. She's full of adrenaline. Her heart's just going bananas. And her lungs feel like she's been running for a long time, like sprinting through this forest. The next thing she knows, she's back in her bed, wide awake, but the heart is still going.
Yeah.
She's still covered in sweat.
Well, I mean, in saying that, though, I mean, you could have some really visceral dreams which can elicit that kind of reaction. Like, it can cause your heart to start racing and for you to sweat. That actually can occur. So we can't jump yet to the conclusion that this is very real. She could just be having extremely realistic dreams.
Yes, that's true. And all of this could be said for all of these people that report these abduction experiences, except... they all have the same dreams.
Well, that, but also if they have marks, I find that to be the most intriguing. If they come back with weird marks, it's normally the triangular mark that they have. Some people have scoop marks. Also, the other factor is, you know, it's like they'll start coming out with a phantom pregnancy.
Günstig ohne App. Bei Aldi gibt es einen Preis für alle. Diese Woche Bio-Joghurt mit Crispy Müsli, 150 Gramm für nur 89 Cent. Oder Iglo-Rahmspinat, 750 Gramm für nur 1,69 Euro. Entdecke weitere Angebote in deinem Aldi Nord. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
Well, she started to get really depressed after this because these experiences kept occurring and she was completely powerless to stop them. She couldn't control them at all. And she said, I was forced to reevaluate the philosophical conclusions she had made about the world and the universe. She became angry. And eventually her anger and curiosity to a degree outweighed her fear. And she came up with this mantra. She would say this out loud every night, not to herself, but to her abductors. She would say, I know you're out there. Come and get me face to face. As in, stop knocking me out. Stop putting me into this weird unconscious state. Come and meet me face to face. So this went on for months. She would say this out loud. And finally, something occurred. September 1991. I've got to admit that maybe all of this is my mistake.
Yeah.
But I will never admit that publicly. After the show's over, I might pull you aside and apologize for getting some of the dates wrong.
Yeah.
But officially,
we'll see.
Yeah. While the tape's rolling, I am correct.
Yeah.
All right? Mm-hmm. Dear diary, she says, I spent last night restlessly tossing and turning, my intuition screaming at me that something was wrong. Finally, my sixth sense alerted me that they were coming. So all these physical reactions start occurring before she has this concrete idea in her head.
It's fascinating how, as well, it's like, I know it's taken months for her to do this mantra, but it's like, it's just been enough to break this spell that it seemingly has over her. And this is like, it's funny, like this repetitive kind of mantra, like you hear it in other depictions of people having paranormal experiences. If you use a mantra or some type of affirmation, it seems to be able to break this spell or whatever it is they have to control people.
It definitely seems like they respond because she kind of creeps out of bed and she's preparing for this because she has this feeling that it's coming, they're coming.
But she's not paralyzed this time.
No, she goes into the living room and there's a freaking disc hovering outside the window, this silver disc. It's right there. It's in the moonlight, clear as day. And her reaction is, and she dives behind the couch and starts crying. And her face goes bright red, not because she's scared, but because she's embarrassed that she's scared, because she's hyped herself up for months going like, I'm going to take him, like, come and get me. And then they show up and she's terrified. She just can't control her emotion. And this disc, she said, left. And because it left, she feels some sense of, oh, like they actually responded to me being afraid. In a positive way. So she has a glimmer of hope that maybe things can change. Maybe it's not going to be this continuous, relentless nightmare.
Why does she interpret that, though, as being positive? At the best,
because they didn't come
neutral.
And, even though she was terrified, they didn't come and take her like they usually do.
Mm.
It's like they came, they gave her this opportunity to face them in this conscious state, fully conscious state, and she wasn't able to deal with it, so they left. And throughout the book, I've got a painting on the screen here. She's included these paintings to represent these experiences. This one's called Chicken Little. And towards the end of this segment, I'll just bring up some of the paintings and go through some of the stories without going through her diary entries. And after this, the next entry is October the 10th, 1991, where she describes, again, being pulled out of this state of sleep by an entity grabbing her nose. She says she feels its fingers on the bridge of her nose and it starts pulling. And she finds herself then in a different place. Again, no clothes on. Like they always remove her clothes somehow. She's naked on this pier and the ocean's out in front of her. She doesn't know where this is, but the pier's all wet. She can feel it under her feet and she's brought to the edge of the pier and she looks down and there's these figures, there's six of them, entities floating under the water.
See, this is becoming more dreamlike.
Yeah, this is
like,
super
that sounds very dreamlike.
And they're kind of sitting down in a circle 10 feet below the surface. She gets this telepathic message that one of the members of the group is leaving and it's her turn to fill the space.
Oh.
What? So she starts kicking and screaming. She's like, no, get me out of here. And again, she's back in the bed, like kicking and screaming. So again, it's this fine line between dream, real. Was her physical body in the bed the whole time and her soul was taken somewhere else for this experience? We don't know.
Yeah, I mean, and as absurd as that sounds, you know, we know now that there are reports of people that have these sorts of experiences. Like, if you're not familiar with them, a great example is a woman who describes herself being abducted from her car. And as she's abducted from her car, she's looking down upon her body so she can see through the car, and she's still sitting in the car. But the Greys are doing a typical abduction performance to her while she's got her ethereal body on board this craft. Mm. And there are multitudes of examples of that.
Well, after this, she has to tell Greg because her boyfriend, he actually woke up this time from her thrashing, and she's like, what is wrong? What's going on with you? She tells him about the nightmares, and he's just totally focused on Baywatch. He's like, okay, babe, can we have pasta for dinner? Like, he really doesn't understand it, doesn't really want to understand it, doesn't have time to understand it. She tries another strategy. She starts bringing home UFO documentaries for him to watch, like, every night.
You can't force people into it, though. I mean, if you're not interested in these topics, it's just you can't get someone to look into it.
Dude, I'm interested in these topics, and if you brought me home a UFO documentary every night, I would kill myself. My God.
That's a good point. Well, I think, though, for the most part, like, people that have an interest in this, you know, they've had some kind of experience, like something. Like, they've had, on some level somewhere in their lives, they've had some type of experience. But if he hasn't, it's not going to work.
Even if Greg had been interested, she said his career had consumed his life. The bigger Baywatch became, the further away they drifted. So their relationship's kind of petering out, basically. You can see this coming. But then another entry, October the 18th, 1991. Dear Diary, she says, a bright blast of light forced my eyes open. I was walking through a sea of glowing mist accompanied by an entourage of little gray beings. Astonished that my consciousness and my control were left intact, I savored the opportunity to observe every detail and commit them to memory. And so, yeah, this is interesting. She's like totally free of their control. She can move, look around at will. She's not paralyzed. And she has this chance to ask this burning question of who was responsible for this. Like, obviously, these little creatures were following their leader, following instructions. So she actually blurts out, take me to your leader. She says it's the cheesiest thing you could say, but that's how it came out. She just blurts it out. And she says all these little grays, they kind of stop and look at each other as if like they're getting instructions, mental instructions, like ants or something. And she gets a sense of agreement from them. And they all turn around about face and start walking with her in the other direction. And she's like, oh crap, it worked. Where are we going? She describes approaching this huge set of double doors. And the doors kind of part majestically as they enter. And then she's plunged into blackness. She loses consciousness. Now, she regains consciousness as they're approaching the same set of doors from the other side and exiting that room that they just entered. So obviously, it's like
they have a great deal of control over what she experiences or recalls.
They allowed her to be conscious for a certain part of the experience, but when she went to see the leader, that's not allowed. She has to be blacked out. Sorry, you can't experience that. You can't have conscious recall of that.
I don't want to preempt it too much, but I've got a really bad feeling that the leader is not like the others. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Just doing a little
little
insectoid
Mantoidian
move. So she said, look, my request had been granted, but remained wrapped in a cocoon of forgetfulness. And she was hopeful, though, because they responded to the request. So she's like, things are changing. They actually acquiesced to a desire of mine.
I don't know if it's acquiescing, though. I think it's that she really is breaking, at least to some level, the control that they have over her. She's becoming, and this is why they act so subversive. This is why it's all done in the dark. It's done in, you know, remote, isolated locations. It's done because if people don't know what's going on and they shut themselves down psychologically, then it's got the phenomenon. The intelligence behind the phenomenon has complete control.
Well, you've got to remember these beings are the masters of control of human psychology.
Yep.
And
they understand it exceptionally well.
They understand how we think, and it's like they understand how to keep someone on board despite the terrifying evil that they're committing.
Yeah, it's like this alien Stockholm syndrome that happens to just so many people in this field. And you said something in the last show, actually hinted towards, I'm like, yeah, it's like we were talking about video games, right? And you were saying that you had heard a lecture or you were listening to some philosophy about this idea that video games, for example, like let's say an alien intelligence came along, they could actually use them, for example, to program people to think in a certain way. And if you start thinking in their way, in the intelligence's way, well, then you can be controlled because it's already done. I'm like, this is what people don't realize. They are so exceptionally good at human psychology, even though they're cold and they understand us, they can completely control us.
Well, it's all, you could say they're giving her a little bit of leeway so that she'll endure and be more maybe pliable later on.
Is that why? Yeah. Is it like, because if they do have complete control, well, then why would they adjust what they're doing? It's because she is resisting. And so the way to allow, it's like that old saying, it's like, if you try to cling onto something, like a handful of sand, for example, if you try to clip really tightly, all the sand will just fall out of your hand. Whereas if you let go a bit, the sand will just stay in your hand. It's the same thing with these abductees.
Well, part of that psychology comes in about a month later. So she has another entry in November of 1991. She says the eyes have returned. And she starts to have these visions of these giant eyes floating above her bed at night. She's done a painting of them here to represent what she's seeing. They're like 3 foot across. They're huge.
Yeah.
And they're floating over her bed at night while she's watching. She's awake watching them.
This is what stands out about Carlsberg is that her experiences do differ quite significantly to the standard abduction trope. The standard abduction trope is, you know, a beam of light through the window, you're paralyzed in bed, then you find yourself lifted out of bed and you're on some craft. And that's pretty much the crux of most of these, at least from a popular culture reference. What she's describing here, though, of like having weird 3 foot eyes hovering over her bed, it's highly unusual. So is it that she's just recalling more of what's going on here, or is she just a very vivid dreamer?
It's a little from column A and a little from column B, but I wouldn't say that there's a standard abduction experience that doesn't include incredible bizarreness that sounds dreamlike. And remember, she said that they're from another reality. And so things that appear dreamlike to us
are not yet
could
them.
Be normal physical reality to them. We can't really think of it in terms of, you know, our solid understanding of this dimension that we inhabit. But these eyes kept on coming, and the third time they appeared, they started to give her a message. They said to her, "You are us." And these messages from the eyes, again, this is part of the psychology. Eventually, they told her, "You now see how important it is that we start honoring Earth and repairing the damage we have done. It is time to save Mother Earth from her inhabitants."
Oh, this old chestnut.
We've got to save the planet from the evil humans.
Yeah, this is where it becomes standard issue. You know, like, let's start talking about how bad human beings are, and we're here to help you, we're here to rescue. But the funny thing is, they've been interacting with us, we know, for at least, you know, 60, 70 years. How come nothing's gotten better?
Well, she says, "The eyes were telling me I'd inherited knowledge of great importance and that there's something I'm supposed to do with it." She said, "I also received an underlying intimation which suggested by coming out about my abductions, the urgency to be more conscious concerning the environment might be felt by more people."
And I buy it for a second.
So it really is this very specific message that a lot of these abductees are given, that human beings are the problem.
Yeah.
The planet is precious and human beings must be stopped, otherwise they're going to destroy it. And if you let people know about the friendly aliens that are coming to stop the evil humans, more people will rally to your cause. And together we can save the planet. And we have heard this countless times over the years from different angles, from abductees or from these entities themselves through these different people. Later, she's taken and told that there's an unthinkable act occurring, i.e. our planet is being destroyed, and we're all guilty if we do nothing about it. So you listening, you're guilty. You're guilty right now if you don't, like, what's that extremist climate group? Like, if you aren't some climate terrorist.
Just stop oil.
You're guilty. Like,
what? You mean if you use petroleum-based products to stop oil?
If you're not super gluing your face to the Mona Lisa right now. You are guilty of destroying the planet. That's That's the messaging these people are being given by these entities. She said all of a sudden this wasn't about poor little old me and my abductions anymore. It had transformed into an issue of not only global but universal concern.
Yeah, you know what I think is going on here? This is another standard issue thing that happens with abductees. You're special, right? You're special. And something like, you know, a divisive issue like climate change and all that kind of stuff, for whatever reason, it does light up certain pathways of importance in people's brains. Oh, I'm doing something that's important, even though you're usually a complete hypocrite and you're flying around in jumbo jets and you're making millions of dollars in movies. But no, we have to stop oil. You know, some of these people that do this stuff. For whatever reason, it kind of elicits this strange virtue signaling of importance.
Yeah.
Like, this is what these greys and ETs seem to do. It's like, you're important. That's why we're going for you.
Well, the whole save the planet, green Schtick. Extremism messaging that these abductees have been given for so many decades, it's really interesting to look at it because you look at the modern extreme version of that, take the alien idea out of the picture. Essentially, it's anti-human
because
they place the Earth, they place Mother Earth ahead of humans. Many of these environmental extremists would be very happy if millions of humans died.
Absolutely, they would
if
be.
If it
Absolutely.
Meant that yep. the Earth would be saved.
Yep. Not and millions, so billions.
It's fundamentally anti-human. And yep. isn't it interesting that these extraterrestrial entities give that exact same messaging to these abductees? Again, it's fundamentally anti-human. And who's to gain when something is anti-human?
Colonizers.
Well, yeah. Someone who's not human is yep. there to gain. So it's very clear what's being done from a psychological perspective. So eventually she gets in touch with, what's that UFO group? The Center for UFO Studies.
Is this with Bud Hopkins?
No, this is, what's the acronym? CUFO or CUFOS or something. Sorry, I shouldn't have drank all that bloody Gatorade before this show. I'm burping all over the place.
It's all right. Center for UFO Studies, let me bring it up.
Anyway, they put her in touch with Yvonne Smith.
Oh, great.
And
okay.
she,
yeah, she's fantastic.
She just says Yvonne in the book, but we know it's Yvonne Smith, who, if you don't know, has been researching alien abductions for a very long time, written a bunch of good books on the topic, and she also does hypnotic regressions herself and has clients. And
well, she's also she's a very warm person and very caring, so I can tell this is why a lot of people, abductees, go to her, because they need to be supported in what they're going through.
Well, she's got these fragmented memories, and Yvonne helps clear up some of these blockages that are in place.
But you know that Yvonne has worked with Bud Hopkins.
You're right.
So that's where some of her training came from. So yeah, that's, I guess, that link back there.
Well, she goes through this regression, and again, it's a typical scenario, metal table. And it's funny. She's like, they've got all this technology. Why are the tables always freezing cold?
Yeah,
because can't they have a warmed up table?
No, they don't care.
Because they don't care. A mechanical device is suspended a few feet above my body, she says. And she describes a tube coming down from the ceiling, being rammed up her nasal passage, as we've heard many times. She cries out in pain. What have I done? Why are you doing this to me? They don't care. They went about their business. Time passes. She wakes up. She's still on the table. Her arms and legs are strapped to horizontal poles. And there's three aliens standing around her with cold, empty eyes. Another grey inches closer, carrying something made of glass.
Oh, this image is awful.
And it's showing her, I've got it on the screen here, this jar with this weird fetus in it.
Why is there a semi-transparent woman in the background holding a rose?
Yeah, we'll get to that. She says, I could hear their thoughts as they discussed the embryo's gender. And as they brought the bottle closer, I understood what was about to happen. My body was to become host for this fetus. I felt trapped in a nightmare far worse than anything I could ever imagine.
Ben, just for one second, these things, stuffing this baby into this unwilling woman, are the things that are trying to say that humanity's bad for the planet.
Yeah. Thanks for the reminder there, Aaron. I don't think it was self-evident enough from the image itself.
I had to reinforce it.
That they're evil. The gruesome scene became even more macabre when a young woman, as you'll see in the background there, is just lingering in the shadows, a human woman. She offers her a rose. And she looks at this woman and she can tell straight away this woman is also trapped there under their control.
That's messed up.
And is just trying to help in some ridiculous way. Later, she describes how the regressions are physically and emotionally painful. Like, she's reliving a lot of this stuff. She said, I followed their focus down towards my legs, which were spread apart, and one of the aliens was removing something from them. So this came later. This is a later regression. An extremely tiny newborn, almost fetal, is removed, and I can hear them saying telepathically, we can't stop the bleeding, or they couldn't stop the bleeding. And she's at this point, she's like begging for death. She's like, please kill me. And then later, a later regression, she says, I'm sitting on the edge of a stool in a dark room filled with incubation boxes. So boxes with fetuses in them. She says, two figures in white gowns approach me in silence. I call them the nurses, she says. They are handing me something. And she describes being handed this fetus, and it's so small and hideous. It's like grotesque, clearly not going to survive. And she's being told, love the baby, hold the baby. Remember when you were so small and you needed to be loved? And she's like, she really has no choice. She holds it and she doesn't even want to look at it. Like, it's disgusting. It's this horrible, gruesome, twisted face. It's just hideous. And she said she put its finger on the arch of its foot, and it's the tip of its finger filled the entire arch of the foot. That's how small it was. And then finally, we skip ahead to February of 1992. She said, I went to sleep last night and I came to as I was ushered by two small gray beings into an empty room. A door opposite the one we entered appeared in the far wall. And she describes three small children, two boys and a girl, scurrying into the room accompanied by a female elder. And the female child stops just beyond arm's reach and is just staring at her. And it's like a hybrid girl. It's like half human, half gray. And the most healthy reproduction she's ever seen in these experiences. And one of the gray escorts, one of these beings, makes this sweeping motion with its hand as if to say, look at what we've created. Look at our masterpiece.
How mangly of them.
And it says to her, it says to Kim, isn't she a beautiful baby? Like telepathically, isn't she a beautiful baby?
How does she react?
And well, normally it's off-putting because these entities are cold, lifeless, very calculated. Everything's
callous.
Everything's like a procedure that they have to complete. It's all business-like. But now it's all changed. There's this real tangible pride that she's picking up, that the mission's a success, that they have this perfect toddler. And she said this girl was beautiful. Like she obviously had the alien features, but clearly very healthy and quite pretty. But she didn't want to participate. It's like they started to do the whole give her a hug, you know, bond with this child. But she's like, I don't want to do it. This is a trick. I don't know. And she's also worried if this child is mine because of these experiments, I don't want to make that connection because then yep. I will lose her.
Yep.
And so when they realized, the entities realized she wasn't going to cooperate, bang, she's back in her bedroom. So she realized, because when she was growing up, even into her 20s and 30s, her friends would always say, like, when are you having kids? Why don't you and Greg want kids? And she's like, I do want kids, but I've always had this fear. You know, she opened up to her really close friends and said, I've always had this crazy fear that if we have kids, they're going to be taken away from me. And it was in that moment, after that experience, she understood where this fear came from. Because obviously, this creation that they've shown her, that they're proud of, it's taken many discarded, broken creations to get to this one that worked. And she realizes she's now nursed or held or seen countless of these disfigured freaks that have been tossed in the trash and died.
Yeah.
Because of these experiments.
Well, that's what I meant by them being, you know, callous. Like, they just have no regard for human life. And I was thinking about this because in the past I've said, look, I think there is something spiritual that they want from us. There's something going on. And that kind of ties in with this, right? They can genetically and from a materialistic perspective produce whatever. Like this hybrid, you know, they can have advanced DNA hybridization technology. Who knows what they have, what they're doing. They can produce these things, but there's something missing. And that's and because obviously it's half human, it's like the soul,
the spirit
side is not being nurtured. So what do? They abduct these women, they bring them up, they try to fake them to say, this is your baby. And like a cuckoo, they try to get that woman to give it that energy, that connection, that love.
Well, she's got a really close friend, Daryl, who understands a little bit of these topics, and she confides in him about these regressions she's done with Yvonne. And she says, she basically describes the story I just told you. And he's like, don't say anything, wait here. And he runs to his car, like he just disappears, runs to his car. He comes back and he says, you've got to see this. He's just bought a copy of the book Secret Life by David Jacobs. And remember, in her experience, she's told, look at the beautiful baby, or isn't she a beautiful baby? If you go into David Jacobs' book, and David Jacobs, for those who don't know, has been incredibly, what's the word?
Outspoken.
Diligent with his research in UFO abductions for decades. And he's written 3 or 4 books on the topic.
He cops a lot of slack, I've noticed. Like, and even here, you're going to forward by John Mack, you know, who was revered in the UFO community. But David Jacobs gets, you know, kind of panned as being this, you know, alarmist. But I'm like, I don't think he's an alarmist by any means, right? Because he's talking directly to abductees and he's connecting the dots.
Well, it's one of those instances where if he's right, it's the most uncomfortable truth you could imagine.
Well, that's why he gets attacked.
Well, he basically opens the book for her, and Jacobs has a section that precisely says it's in Touching and Holding, and it starts talking about the experiences of the abductees he's been working with. And he says, typically the aliens bring the abductee into the child presentation room, and he describes the scenario I just laid out to you. This happens time and time again. The entities will come in with one of these hybrid freaks and say, oh, here you go, hold it, touch it. But he said later, the woman senses the communication. Isn't this a nice baby? Isn't this a beautiful baby? Wouldn't you like to hold the baby? Hold the baby? The exact same thing she's just experienced. One woman was told the baby would get sick if she didn't hold it, that it would develop a rash. Therefore, she had to hold the baby. The woman will hear the directive, nurse the baby, put the baby to your breast, feed the baby. And so he goes through the 4 ways they try and forcefully instill bonding between these hybrids and the human abductees. He talks about the first way to instill this thought. Beautiful baby. Look how beautiful and nice this baby is.
It's intergalactic gaslighting.
Well, the second manner is that when they're encouraged to hold the baby, they use some kind of technology or trick. And some abductees have said the baby actually transforms in front of their eyes.
Wow.
So it goes from something gruesome and hideous that they don't even want to look like to a beautiful looking baby.
Yep.
And they're like, oh, no, it's pretty now. And the fear is kind of bypassed in that way. The third way is they tell her that the baby is her baby. Yep. Now, Jacob says this could likely be true because they've been taken, obviously, for these experiments. And the third method is really bizarre, which is what I mentioned at the start of the show. It's the dummy birth. He's come
across about this.
Quite a few cases where the aliens arrange a delivery. So someone gets abducted, the woman gets abducted, she comes to, she's on the table, she's in the stirrups, she's in this position to give birth, and the aliens communicate that she's about to have a baby. And she's in this drugged out, confused state, not even thinking that she wasn't pregnant, and she will start to see movies of herself giving birth in her mind. Or sometimes it's even they get lazy and they just show a movie of another woman giving birth in their mind. And there'll be like sound effects, this baby crying, and then the alien will like bend down and reach between her legs.
It's like a cooking show. Here's one I prepared earlier.
Yeah, and bring up this weird hybrid fetus and hand it to the woman.
Does that ever work?
Well, they're just in such an altered state, they just always take the baby. And then after they take it, they're like, hang on a second, what is going on?
You know what's fascinating about this, though, is like they're clearly powerful. Like they're clearly immensely powerful. They clearly have technology that is beyond human comprehension. And yet they still haven't taken over the planet. And so they still pull these charades. So it makes me feel like with these things that it's like it's this old sense of in the absence of force is deception. And it's like, this is what these things do. This is why we don't know anything publicly about the phenomenon. We don't know what's going on because for whatever reason, these things, and it makes me start thinking about the agreements that are allegedly out there with Eisenhower.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like there was some agreement made between the Earth's elites and these extraterrestrials back in the 1940s, the late 1940s, early 1950s, that they could abduct a certain number of people from Earth every year. And I think it was something absurd. It was like 300,000 people off Earth every year. And they had to report it to some central agency. But I'm like, we all know how government is pretty terrible. So how is it going to be actually keeping those sorts of records?
Those stories that get spread around. Yeah. The idea that they just broke the rules immediately.
Yeah, straight away.
Millions and millions of people were being taken.
yeah, straight away. They just didn't care. So I'm like, I don't know what's going on. And this is what makes me think that there is something, you know, and people disagree with me, but that's fine. There is something more spiritual going on here than this physical nuts and bolts stuff. Mm. It's like, because these things are inherently, I truly believe that these things are inherently evil. Like they are dark, they are anti-human. I know we joke about the Alien Hate League, but I absolutely do hate them. And I feel like this is some war. And it's almost like people have to kind of be conned into agreeing to allow them to come and do this.
You've got to understand that there's enough evidence to say that there's something really going on. You can divorce this from the UFO phenomenon all you want, but it's obviously connected, and I think it would make sense for it to be, if not the most important factor, one of the key driving factors to why any aspect of the phenomenon isn't publicly acknowledged by the military or by the government or by anyone else. It's because this is too terrifying for anyone to want to deal with.
Absolutely.
And you're who absolutely wants to be on. Responsible for this?
Well, how do they protect people? This is you the can't. Thing, right? If it comes out publicly that this is what is going on, like if the government acknowledges it, the first thing people are going to say is, you're my government, you're supposed to protect me, how are you going to do so? And the response is going to be, I don't know.
So she continues with these experiences. There's another one where she has this feeling that something's been implanted in her. She kind of, it doesn't go well. Like she feels something's wrong and she's forced to like hold her stomach, her hand on her stomach and her other hand on her head for like 6 hours in bed and she can't move them. They're like some force is holding
healing or
something's holding it there as if, yeah, it's meant to heal this horrible pain in her stomach. And then that night, as you can see on the screen here, and I've got a video of her describing this a little bit later.
These grays walking through the wall here.
There's four of them just kind of merge through the wall and start taking her up. And she said as they started to rise towards the ceiling, one of them was paired with her. It was basically grabbed her.
Like a chaperone.
Like to take her through the ceiling because obviously they're becoming immaterial. So maybe that needs to hold her to do that. She said she tried to like push its face away and her finger went in its mouth.
Ew.
She said it was all wet and gross in there. And she's got a picture of it there where she's like, it's a finger in the gray's face. And she said, because they were touching each other, they became mentally connected. And she was feeling all these feelings of disgust and filth. And then as they're floating up towards the ceiling, she realizes, oh, they're not my feelings.
Yeah.
Like this entity is disgusted by humans. It's like, ugh.
Yeah, see?
It doesn't like being close to her. It's grossed out. But then she said, it stunned me with a human gesture. She said, this alien gray kissed me. It kissed her on the lips.
Yeah. No tongue.
She said, I marveled in disbelief. I didn't know if it was a trick or if the being was actually had feelings for me. Or did we have feelings for each other? She says, I knew I was delirious. Of course, this was a trick. And then another powerful psychic wave filled her with love, she said. So again, it's just
this
like
is assault.
Form of control.
Yeah, it's assault.
Moments later, I was jogged awake by the bouncing of my body upon the surface of a cold metal gurney rolling down a hospital-like hallway back to their true nature. She says, then they're back to the normal, cold, calculated, let's get her in there. And this is interesting. She says she's being wheeled down to this other area. And as she's on this gurney, she's being wheeled down. She looks down on the ground and there's these life forms she's never seen before. She said they lay motionless on the floor and they were like soft, shapeless mounds of bread dough, but each radiating intelligence. Like they were all telepathic, like bloop, 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 just blobbing
like
everywhere.
Proto material for the greys to later on be used to turn them into drones.
She had no idea, but she speculated maybe they're like pets. It's like they're dogs they're like sentient blobs of dough just sliming
just,
around.
That's what I'm thinking. It just sounds like there's going to be slime everywhere.
But anyway, she makes the case that while she's in these experiences, the whole nature of it is not like anything you can describe. It's very dreamlike in that they have total control of her consciousness. They can flick her on and off like a switch. And this happens multiple times. Once she's flicked off and then flicked on, and she finds herself in a hallway and she realizes she's got this, like her heart's beating faster. She gets a feeling like she's escaped, like she's gotten out of a room or something and she's on her own. And she walks down this hallway and she feels this telepathic presence behind her. And she's like, oh shit, they've found me.
Yeah.
They're going to get me. And she turns around and it's an old lady. There's this old wrinkled lady on the ship. And she approaches her and the telepathically, this old lady, oh, you lost, dearie.
I've been dragged onto a freaking spaceship. Yes, I'm lost.
And she's like, can you tell me where the elevators are? And she's like, second door on the right. And she says she was so wrinkled, there was something off. Like it was probably a gray giving a mask or, yeah, you know, some kind of psychic projection or something. So she goes to the elevator. She chooses the wrong door. She hears a telepathic voice saying, no, it's the other door. She goes to get in the right elevator and then immediately there's four greys coming to get her and she realizes this creepy old lady had summoned them. Anyway, she gets wheeled into this other room. And this is where it just gets so bizarre. Like you think abduction stories are bizarre. They always take these twists that you don't see coming. She's in this room, still drowsy, but there's this, how do I describe it? She calls it, it's almost like a coffin, but it's made of plastic. And she watches as this hand comes up and starts to unzip it from the inside.
So is it like a body bag?
It's like a plastic see-through body bag. And she watches as this perfect Ken doll starts getting out of the plastic bag. Like
this is very Rocky Horror Show.
He's breathtakingly handsome, she says. The most amazingly handsome male face. His features are so perfect. He looks like he's the handiwork of some doll maker. And he gets out of this plastic bag and walks over to her. And he's like, Kim, it's Stuart. Wake up. Because she's still lying like half paralyzed on this gurney. She said, when our eyes meet, something stirred inside of me. It was a profound recognition, she said. I knew this man and I was in love with him.
It wasn't the gray that she's making out with before, is it? In some man costume.
Yeah, it's like he's taken on board. He's now controlling this avatar,
yeah,
of this hot Nordic guy. And she says, irrationally, I was in love with this guy and this thought flooded me with panic. Maybe the greys had reached into my secret heart and like designed this man for me. It was like her perfect guy.
No, it's not. Keep this image in your head of this Nordic Pleiadian, you know, built like space Fabio guy, but blonde and blue eyed. It comes up a lot in some of the reports I'm going to be telling you in a moment.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's a bit weird.
Interesting.
Yeah.
He's like, wake up, Kim. It's okay. It's Stuart. You remember me. And this is a different kind of telepathy. It's like soft and masculine. It's not like the greys. It's cold and heartless. And she says, I had no memory of this guy, but I was in love with him and knew that we knew each other and I wanted to spend the rest of my life with him. She says, I was filled with this intense longing. And with Stuart's arrival, I was now in heaven. So she's like, she's ready to stay on this spaceship forever now. Like she's totally happy. Let's settle in. Let's have babies. Like she's ready to go. All the maternal instincts kick in. And she said she recognized, like she's convinced he's a real guy and they do have this relationship. But they're alternate dimensions. They're like parallel worlds. It's like all the old stories of the Fae having a fairy wife in the other dimension.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Being married to the Fae. Like they even believe that in Africa in some places that you have this spirit wife in another dimension. It's the same kind of concept. And she basically understands that she'll never be able to have this conscious relationship because it's like two parallel worlds that only occasionally intermix. Anyway, her consciousness flicks off and then on again, and she's now somewhere else. He's now wearing a lab coat and he's like got his finger to his ear as if he's getting some instructions. And he turns to her and he basically says, come to me, everything's going to be okay. And he pulls out the biggest freaking hypodermic needle you've ever seen. It's like 12 inches long. And she says, something happened to me. Every cell in my body recoiled from this needle. And instantaneously, my consciousness imploded into a ball of light and I woke up in my bed. And she's like sitting up in her bed, staring at the clock, thinking, what the hell was that? Like, she's just teleported herself out of there.
Is it also like a betrayal? So there's some betrayal that's kind of initiated something inside her?
I don't
like
know.
Like a reaction?
It gets even weirder from here.
How is that possible?
So August the 30th, 1992, and I'm getting towards the end because we've got our Plus extension coming up, but it's her birthday and she goes out to dinner with a friend, comes back early. She's like in bed by 10:30. She's exhausted. Anyway, she wakes up, like she has that abduction feeling. She wakes up. She's now on the side of a mountain range right next to a cliff face. There's like a stone cliff. And there's like some weird ticket booth built into the cliff face. Like she looks around, it's kind of dark. She realizes she's still on Earth, probably America somewhere. But this cliff, this mountain, and there's an attendant there, like a human, this woman. And the woman very coldly says something like, as soon as you check through the gate, you can get acquainted with the complex. Just put your details in the ticket machine there and there's the entry. And there's this ticket booth. Like, she takes a ticket. These doors of the mountain open up and she's inside this complex. She blacks out again. She wakes up. There's three doctors hovering over her that are like...
So greys in lab coats.
Weird, yeah, grey humanoids. And then she's knocked out. Something's implanted in her stomach. She's knocked out again. She wakes up. She's now in a giant auditorium filled with thousands of people, like thousands of humans. And she gets...
They're actual humans?
Yeah. She gets a sense that they're all abductees. And there's this guy on stage explaining to them all why all of this is happening. Like, you're being abducted for this and we're getting you ready for that and make sure you remember this and, you know, all of this will be activated later when you do this. And she's like way back in the stands.
Is he a human?
I think so, yeah. I think it's like a human explaining everything. And she starts yelling. Like, she's like, what the fuck is this? She starts yelling out. She's like, she says something like, why do you bring us up here unconscious? We can remember some of it and then we're unconscious again. This doesn't make sense. Just let us remember all of it. She's like, if you're trying to get us to remember, why is some of it blocked out? She's like yelling from the back row.
Because then you'll be able to piece the plan together and potentially resist.
She's too far back for this guy explaining it to hear her, but she catches the attention of a guard. It's a black woman in military fatigues who comes up to her and stands next to her, this young black woman, and is like, bends down, is like, what question are you asking? And she says, I'm out trying to figure out what's going on. She says, you're being prepared for something. She's like, what? I know we're being prepared for something. What are we being prepared for? And she's like, I can't tell you that. She says, then at least give me a hint. I want to know what's going on. She's like, And eventually, obviously, this outburst got her in trouble because this black military security guard.
This is surreal. This is absolutely surreal.
Escorts her from the auditorium. And she said, when I stepped through the door of the auditorium, everything went black and I'm staring at my alarm clock, 4:35 a.m. in the morning. What the hell's going on?
So you'll get escorted essentially from a space airport by space TSA.
Yeah.
And it's like,
You can't, everywhere you go, there's like a sassy black woman to keep you in line. Even when you're abducted, you get escorted out by a sassy black woman.
But I don't understand. Like, because she's wearing a military uniform though. Is it like, does this tie in with my labs? Which soldiers? I know that you've obviously got non-disclosure agreements and national security agreements and all this kind of stuff to adhere to, but you've got humans wearing military uniforms that are doing this to abductees. It just none of it makes any sense.
It gets stranger from here. Like, she gets abducted by guys in military fatigues, and she's at an airbase, and there's just military guys everywhere. But then UFOs start landing, and the military guys are like waving them in on pointing out where to land, like on an aircraft carrier. She then says these goons come in, and she finds herself in the back of a car, and there's a guy like yelling her to get down, like stay down in the back seat. And he's flying through these streets at night, and she looks behind, there's this light, and there's a UFO chasing them. And she claims that when she looks back at the UFO, this sign drops out of it, like Looney Tunes, that says, stop drinking alcohol before you go to bed.
Oh my God. This is okay, so what this is now, I'm convinced. Now I'm convinced that, I mean, aside from the really horrible, gruesome stuff, like let's put that to aside for a moment. This actually more feels like what I'm beginning into with the Druids, right? And this whole concept, like these ancient Celtic ideas of a bear being essentially it was brought out later on by other researchers, but they based it on Celtic ideas of these dimensions that kind of drift between each other. It's like Halloween, really. It's like certain times of the year or in certain circumstances, astrological alignments, whatever, the barriers, the permeable, or the barriers between worlds becomes permeable, right? But sometimes the intelligence, which is on the other side and wants to get through, it comes through, and what it does is this idea that it basically responds to the person. Mm. So it injects into that person. It's still very real, but it's based on like this subjective experience of the person who's witnessing it. So I'm like, is this what's going on with this woman? Like, she's being exposed to something that is of high strangeness and otherworldly, but it's creating this absurdity and these strange, it's almost like a very advanced hallucination.
Yeah, great point. And she does describe earlier on in the book that what becomes apparent is that they have the ability to completely fabricate an experience for you to go through, and it will feel 100% real.
I reckon that last part definitely was that, like going into this auditorium.
Because they understand that experiences have much more lasting impressions than words or movies or books, or like when you go through an experience, it is in you. Well, and so they will create very specific experiences for a specific purpose. So a lot of these things that she's going through, it's stated earlier, and she makes it clear that it's not necessarily something real, but it feels real. And that is in essence the problem. You can't tell what's real and what's not. Let me quickly play a video and then we'll go into the plus extension. This is, she says after this, she was interviewed by a Fox program called Sightings.
Oh, I know Sightings.
Yeah, it came out. This is like mid-90s. Yeah. And she didn't even have time to think about it. It was like, hey, do you want to go on this show? It's like tomorrow, we really need to hear from you. And she didn't even think about the implications of going on the show or what her workmates would think about her or anything. She just went on and she just let it all out. So forgive my very rough cut of this video. I just kind of slapped this together. But this is some of the excerpts of her in this episode. Let's take a listen.
At 4:30 in the morning, I saw this image of these four beings just move through this wall. They just, like it wasn't there. And they came over to me, two at my feet, two in my head, and they started to lift me up to the ceiling. Right. They're not interested in your mate, they're interested in you. So what they do is they render the person that you're with unconscious, find yourself on a table and these creatures around you with instruments and you have no idea what they're doing and they don't tell you. They have a mission, a job to do, and they're doing their job with little respect to their subjects. There's one being in particular that I always recognize, and he's not a gray. He's taller, he's thinner, he's got a bigger head, he's got bigger eyes. His limbs are very praying mantis-like. I remember being on a table with my head turned away, not wanting to look at this creature. And then when I looked at him, I just recognized him as the one that I hated.
That's familiar.
It. Yeah, very familiar. If you've heard that last episode on Plus,
these are the ones running the show.
And this is why I keep on saying I feel like this stuff is inherently evil, because these damn things, these insectoids, they are absolutely terribly evil.
I've been shown babies. I've been asked to hold children and babies. I've been asked to give these children affection. And these children aren't alien children, and they're not human children. They're somewhere in between. I've been on a table, and I've seen something removed from my body that I will call a fetus. The baby was so small, I couldn't believe that it could live on its own. I remember putting my finger in the arch of its foot. I was afraid to look at the face. I was afraid to see what it looked like.
There seems to be an enormous interest in the emotional side of this, too, on the part of the aliens. They want us to hold these odd little children, these babies. They want to see how a mother will hold in love a child, things which to us are instinctive.
That was Bud Hopkins, wasn't it?
Yeah, there's David Jacobs right at the end there as well. So, yeah, I mean, the mention of the insectoid, the mantises, which is why I wanted to go into this, because her name came up on that last Plus show when we covered that artist, Stuart Davis.
Can you see the similarities, though, in his experiences? And so if you didn't hear it, in his experience, one of the earliest things that happened was that he saw an orb floating around his property, and his daughter saw it as well. And it was coming up close to the house. What did Kim describe? She's described this orb-like thing paralyzing her through the window. Like, it's the same thing, Ben. And then once again, you've got these damn insects popping up. People go, that's absurd. That's crazy. But how many reports do we hear of abductees? You know, they'll describe their, openly describe their experiences with these gray-type beings. But then when you dig in or you go through hypnotic regression, these things will come out where it's like, oh, yeah, there happened to be a mantis standing in the corner.
Yeah, the one running the show, the one in charge, the one giving the instructions.
Like rubbing its pincers together.
The one giving the orders. These guys. So when we come back after the break for our Plus extension, I'll reveal what she thinks of them, what she believes they are doing. And yeah, they are particularly disgusting. Along with the involvement of the CIA.
Well, yeah, no doubt they're involved. No doubt.
Again, it's this like... and also... Where is he? Have I got him? There he is.
What is that? It's like some androgynous, grey, small, B-cupped humanoid.
She says he's not a grey, he's not a human, and he's not a mantis. He's something else.
Ew.
He's like a...
But why is he shoving a human through a wall?
Well, he's getting
obviously
her...
Obviously abducting.
He's getting her into his favoured position. Which is coming up in Plus, not for the free show.
Any other marginalized groups you want to insult before we...
Yes. You want to sign up to Plus, don't you? Don't you?
Stop it.
To find out what happens in my lair.
We know what happens. Something gets inserted somewhere. We know that's what's going to happen.
One salt and pepper shaker, please.
Yeah. I need to put salt. I need to get salt and pepper shakers into the store, actually.
You're just on the metal table and this device comes down. It's like a giant pepper shaker on a metallic arm.
And it was, remember that guy though? He was all about, the answer is androgyny. It's like, it's this guy. It all makes sense now. It all comes together, Ben.
If you're missing out on the inside joke, that's because you're not on Plus. Head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Sign up today. Get to hear what this creep is up to in his special alien lair. Mysteriousuniverse.org/plus for all the details. $9 a month. Help support your favorite show. Sign up today and get access to all the extras we put out, which includes big extensions every single Friday and, of course, exclusive shows that come out on Tuesdays as well. And if you sign up for MU Max, you can get access all the way back to these ancient shows in our back catalog going back 2011 and earlier.
We need to get rid of them.
2008.
I'm just going to get rid of them. Like, listen to them while you can, because there is going to come a point where I'm just going to delete everything.
No, this is quality stuff.
It has to go.
Listen to this man.
All from the Dead and the Art of Close Encounters. I'm Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright, and welcome back for the new season.
I'm really excited to be here. It's great.
It is great. Yeah, we had a nice week off.
That's not even me.
Did you do anything special?
Not really. I built a computer, which was really stupid.
tell us.
I remember that. The whole thing flooded.
For some reason, I don't like desktops, and you decided to build a new computer, so for some reason I'm like...
Oh, enthralling, Ben! Please play more to encourage people to sign up for it.
See what you're getting into if you... half of last. Aaron's 2011 PC build in the archives.
God. Stop doing this yet.
I'm trying to get us banned, all right? I'm trying our hardest to get us banned. And you know what happens? We keep getting more subscribers and more bloody viewers. You're stuck doing this forever. So sign up for Plus, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Huge stuff coming up after the break. We're going to be looking at some of these amazing structures in New York. Aaron's going to reveal what's behind the New York Stone Chambers, the true mystery. Who built them? It was white people.
No, it's true. Well, it was redheaded white people, apparently. Druids.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing?
Racist. It's so late. I just don't care for this episode. That's a wrap for this show. We'll catch you on the flip side. Thanks for being a free listener. But sign up for Plus if you're on Plus. Stick around for great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll see you. Welcome back to your Plus Extension. Great to have you with us. Should we explore this?